be seated. Up until Friday afternoon, it was my intention to preach this morning's sermon in its entirety like this. And it was my intention because I find sometimes that the way that we read these stories have become so domesticated and so institutionalized that we miss the point of what is really being told. And it doesn't inspire us in the way that we need to be inspired. If you, like I, had gone to an Episcopal seminary, you would have been forced in that middle year, the second of 3 years, to return early to back to school in order to take a one-week course that we seminarians lovingly called Read and Bleed. It was basically 5 days with clergy, theater professionals, and other volunteers about how to read and conduct the liturgy. Like, this is how we do it in the Episcopal Church. And the course teaches you to read just as we have heard Beverly read this morning or Brian read the gospel, with a relatively flat, somewhat emotionless presentation so that you, the listener, might insert what you hear and what might inspire you and be dynamic for you in your own faith life. So there are ways that when we read the story, we give commentary with tone and inflection, and the liturgy and the institution wants to banish that from us. And I understand the trajectory of that thought and why we have that. You know, it's not all about you, the reader, or me, the reader. It's about the experience and the story that gets passed on for ages. But there is a real danger there that we're fully inheriting in the church these days. And I want to do my best to deconstruct the calcification of the story itself. In order to do that with today's readings, I need to go backwards 1 week, and you didn't have to be here last week to follow along what I'm going to say. I'm going to retell a story that Mary told last Sunday. And to be fair to Mary, the preacher has an enormous amount of pressure on him or her to deliver commentary on a story in a particular time and a particular context. And Mary's time and context last week was, first off, it was Mother's Day. And second off, it was a family service day. So the trajectory of the sermon on those days, though it may not be completely dedicated to the ears, minds, and hearts of children, primarily it is so. And I need to go backwards a little bit and give some more commentary on this story that we had last week about this woman, Tabitha, also called Dorcas, so we can understand what Peter is telling us today from the Acts of the Apostles, and so we might embody both the Gospel of John and the revelation to John that we've heard alongside that story in a different way. So if you were around here last week, you heard this story about messengers being sent to Jerusalem to summon Peter, the head of the church, a religious elder at the time, thoroughly institutionalized, careful not to break any rules or traditions in order. You know, Peter, you could think of Peter as like growing up on the Upper East Side of Manhattan and like knowing all of his social graces. Like, Peter goes everywhere in a tie. So Peter gets these messengers from Joppa, and they are requesting that he would go to Joppa, that he would travel from Jerusalem, from the Upper East Side of Manhattan, to Joppa, this port town, which is like Long Beach, California, San Pedro, California. and he's responsive to the request. But what we need to know about Joppa itself before we really get into Tabitha, also called Dorcas, which is a curious detail and important, what we really need to know about Joppa is that Joppa was a tough place. We're not talking about Peter going to La Jolla. We're talking about Peter going to a rough port town, like places where cultures come together and industry comes together and the exchange of good and ideas come together, but is also like a fertile ground for crime and darkness and fear. It was a rough place. It was a place that you would never go in a tie. It would make you a target. Peter, nevertheless, is responsive to the message. It's a beautiful understanding of Peter as a leader in this very early moment in the church's history of being open to something new, something different. And so Peter goes to Joppa. He finds this place where Tabitha's body is lying, waiting for Peter to come and offer prayers for her. And the story reads in kind of like a beautiful way. As he entered the room, he found the room full of widows. Widows coming to pay homage to Tabitha, because Tabitha had been so kind to these widows that they are grieving alongside Tabitha's body. And then there's that curious line where it says, like, well, when he came in and he looked around the room and he saw the widows and they were talking about how Tabitha made them garments, he asks all the widows to leave the room before he says the prayers. Some of you remember this detail from the story yesterday. It's interesting, right? Well, here's the deal, y'all. And we don't say this in the church because the church has institutionalized these stories and have domesticated them in a certain way, and they're like things you can talk about in church and things you can't talk about in church. Widows. Widows is a code word for prostitutes. So when you are a woman living in a port city, married to a sea-going man, and that man is killed in another port, lost at sea, succumbs to illness while away, and you live in a patriarchal modeled dynamic culture, you have very few choices about how you might meet the needs that you have in order to survive. And these particular women, though the story doesn't tell us with the word itself, let me assure you, this is what Luke is intending to communicate to us. Tabitha is lying there dead. The room is full of a bunch of prostitutes for whom Tabitha made garments. Not dresses to wear to church on Sunday. Tabitha is like a hardcore feminist social worker who sews lingerie for prostitutes so they might support themselves in a really difficult, challenging place. Nobody's ever told you that before, right? Yeah. You know, honestly, like, I'm sorry and I don't know why. I mean, I guess I know why. It's not, you know, religious and it's not a happy story, but it is nevertheless a powerful and loving story, right? Here is another person giving care to people who are just tossed away by the culture and helping them survive under horrible conditions. That's who Tabitha was. So when Peter strolls into this room in his tie and his Brooks Brothers blazer and his like penny loafers and his gray pants, he's like, wow, I'm in trouble here. I don't really know what to do. And so he does what you would expect them to do. He says, can you please ask these women to step out of the room so that I can focus on what I came here to do? He doesn't leave. He doesn't say Tabitha is not worthy of our prayers. He just invites those women to step outside for a moment. And then Peter, this proper, educated, loving, devout Jew, follower of Jesus, moves over to the body of this hardcore woman who has two names for a reason. She's Tabitha and Dorcas because she is straddling two cultures. She is living both in the Jewish culture, but also the Greek culture. She is a woman of the world. She is a beautiful soul and a bright light and a loving person who is not defined as Peter is by a single culture, but is bicultural in a beautiful way. And as Peter goes to Tabitha's body and lays his hand on her and begins to say prayers for her, what happens? When we read it in church, we're like, and Tabitha was resurrected from the dead. This dead woman comes to life again, church. This woman who was dead is no longer dead. It happened. Someone who was dead became alive again, 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 a third time. Lazarus, Jesus, now Tabitha. That was the story from last week. And then there's this little line at the ending of last week that we get from this week from the Acts of Apostles, which we don't really hear as crazy. Do you remember the Airbnb that Peter got when he was in Joppa? Do you remember where it was? It was over a shop. Anybody remember? It was over the shop of Simon the Tanner, right? Oh, Simon the Tanner. Oh, Simon the Tanner. Simon the Tanner. No, no, no. This was the last place a good Jew should ever spend the night. Simon's job was to take the skin of pigs and turn them into leather. This is the worst place for somebody like Peter to hang his coat and to lay his head. Something huge is happening here in the world of religious practice and religious tradition. It is enormously disruptive. And then we move to the passage or the recounting of the passage that we heard today. We know Peter spends some time in Joppa. Who knows what he was doing there? But Peter spends some time in Joppa. And when he is there, he goes into the synagogue to pray. And we have the recounting of this story. And when he prays, he sees this white sheet come down from heaven. And on the spread out across the white sheet are all sorts and kinds of animals. And he hears this voice from heaven, not like Jesus's voice, but a cosmic, mystical, inspirited voice that says, like, Peter, get up, kill, and eat. And Peter, like, straightens his tie and says, no way. Like, I can't do that. You have to understand, I have followed all the rules. I have never eaten even one strip of bacon in the entirety of my life. There is no way I will do this. Well, we read this story like, Peter has a vision. It's not a dream. The Bible talks about dreams when people have dreams. It's not a daydream. It's not that Peter's mind has wandered. Peter is so connected to the Holy Spirit, to that cosmic, mystical side of the religious, spiritual experience, that he has a vision, and that vision says, Peter, this is so much bigger than you think it is. It includes the tradition, of course, but it is way beyond the tradition. And he comes back in the story that we have today. And the first part of the accounting is like he's back on the Upper East Side of New York. And he's telling all his pals, some of for whom he works, some of his work colleagues, what has happened. And they're like, hey, man, I don't understand why you were eating with those uncircumcised people. It's not just like, hey, man, I don't understand why you were eating with those sailors. It's like, hey, man, I don't understand why you've completely upended the entirety of our tradition for generations. And you, sir, have an accounting to make for that. And he's like, how do you want me to account for a vision? Like, where does the tradition on Sunday morning or Saturday morning talk about vision and the cosmos and the mystical voice of God? He's like, guys, and they were probably all guys. Guys, why are we living from such a narrow perspective? And then there's this other third beat that he's telling the story of that's further disruption of the tradition itself. So messengers came to Jerusalem to get Peter to go to Joppa, and messengers come to Joppa to get Peter to go to Caesarea, right? To meet this family who's had an encounter with the Holy Spirit and is curious. Yeah, but wait, this family, the head of this household is a guy named Cornelius. He's not a first lieutenant, and he's not a four-star general. He's like a major in the Roman army. And he lives in Caesarea, which is one of the strongholds of the Roman Empire. Cornelius is one of those people that in the epistles we hear of, who's described as like a God-fearer. He's a Gentile, but he sits on the back pew of the synagogue on Saturday, like arms folded, heart open, nodding his head, knowing that he can never be included at the center of the religious practice. This is to whom Peter is being sent. He is being sent to one of the primary leaders in the occupying or dominating foreign force in Israel. Cornelius is an enemy of Peter's people. And Peter is responsive to the enemy's request. And when he has this encounter with the enemy that we don't hear in this passage, it's in another part of Acts, he listens to the story that Cornelius tells him. When Cornelius tells him that the Holy Spirit has come upon him and has given him a vision to go send for this man, Peter, Peter is responsive. And you know what he does? He baptizes Cornelius and Cornelius's whole family. He says, tradition, smadrition. You, Cornelius, by virtue of what you have experienced and how you have been responsive to the experience itself, you, sir, are at the center of who we are. This is groundbreakingly disruptive to the religious practice and culture of the day. These stories that we inherit during this season of Easter, post-Easter Sunday, pre-Pentecost, these are stories of disruption. They're not stories that we're just meant to listen to. These are not stories that are meant to be told around a campfire so that we might hear them and be entertained. These are stories that are meant to be lived by. They're meant to inform us, not just then, but on this very Sunday morning. And so you might ask, fair question, well, how to? How do we do that, Jimmy? How would one live this story if one was inclined to do so? I'll say, first off, there's a condition. There's a condition that we must accept. That condition is that we must be willing to get to be a little bit weird. Weirdness is at the center of the Christian faith because it is so disruptive and so counter the culture of the culture of the kingdom of the world. And so the first beat is like a willingness to be a little bit weird. Now, if you're sitting in the pews of St. John's Episcopal Church, even though it's an Episcopal church, and we do have like a reputation for frozen chosen, but if you are sitting in the pews of St. John's Episcopal Church, I know that there's already at least a smidgen of weird in you. Well, I should say, like, maybe you like came from a different place. Like, we get lots of visitors here. You're visiting Jackson Hole and you come from a more, so maybe you're not, maybe you're just like, oh man, that was crazy and we're never going back there ever again. Fine, I get it. I understand it. But you must be a little bit weird. And then there's another move that we make, and I need to give it some explanation. I would say the move that we make is that we need to become people who live fearlessly. Now, let me qualify that. I think it's really important to qualify that, especially in a day and an age where we just like trade on fear more than ever. When I say that you need to have a willingness to live fearlessly, I don't mean to say that you need to live your life in the absence of the emotion of fear. That's not what I mean. What I mean is that you might orient yourself to living courageously, that though the fear comes, perhaps it is fear of being considered weird, perhaps it's fear of disrupting a course of life that you had planned in front of you. I don't know. But when you feel that weirdness, that it doesn't stop you in your tracks, that you're still able to take some action in the face of fear. That's what I mean by living fearlessly. And then I'll give you two options, one that is dreamy and cosmic and mystical, and the other that's practical. And that practical is going to sound political, but I'd argue that it's moral and not political. Let's go dreamy first. Like, okay, Jimmy, I'm inclined. I'm already a little bit weird. I'm already inclined. I've climbed the grand, so I know what it means to take action in the face of fear. I'm inclined, and I think I'm going to take option A, which is the mystical, cosmic option. Okay, here's one way to do it, and you think up your own way, but here's one way to do it. This afternoon, tomorrow it's going to stop raining, right? Maybe. Snowing. Go halfway up Crystal Butte, if you can. If you can't, drive into the park and find a tree. Sit under that tree. Catch your breath. Feel the ground beneath you. Breathe in, breathe out. Get open. Get as open as you can. What does that mean? I don't know. Just get open. Get open. And ask God to come to you in a vision. In a vision for your life. Where you would live courageously embracing love at almost every turn. Ask to hear the voice and see whatever version of your sheet is coming down from heaven. Let me assure you, if you get a vision, and you might, some of us have, if you get a vision, it is going to make you weird. So weird. And that kind of weirdness will be a treasure to you. It will be something that will ground you or carry you through the most disruptive, destructive, terrifying experiences of your life. It will be your tether. What I am inviting you to do is to become one of those people who lives with one foot firmly planted on the ground and the other foot planted in the stars. And maybe you're sitting here thinking, like, that was then, that was those people. No, it happens today to some of us. Thanks be to God. And it might happen to you. Option A. Option B. You heard from John's gospel this lesson that Jesus is giving. It's a pre-resurrection story. These stories that we get from Easter are both the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus, and then there's like a little rewind of like, hey, just so you remember, this is what he said to the people he loved the most right before he knew he was about to die. And one of the things that Jesus says right before he is about to die is that people will know that you are attached to the way that I see things, to who I am and I have been, by the way that you love one another. People will know that we are connected when they see you as loving. He says, like, you have all these laws and all these traditions, but I am giving you a new one, a refresh on that, and that is to love one another. Love in action is at the very center of our grounded faith. And if you listen carefully to these stories, and if we were to follow Peter's lead, to be clear, Peter is the guy that Jesus says, like, you're the cornerstone, man. You're the foundation. I am building all of this upon you. And this move that Peter makes is a move outside their tradition. Peter is actively engaging people who are other than him and his culture. And so what I am inviting you to do in a grounding way is to, in a moment, in an era of cruelty in our own culture, for whatever reason, I am inviting you to be loving to those who are different than you. And I'm not just inviting you to be loving as like an act of goodwill to those different people. I am inviting you to be loving so that you might meet the life that Peter has met, one that has changed him, one that has helped him encounter a God that is so much bigger than the tradition could ever narrate or define or ritualize. What does that look like directly? I can tell you, like, in this current era of our lives, immigration has become a political issue. But I would remind you, and I'll tell you, like, I will tell you straight up, most of the issues that we get in the Bible are ambiguous. Like, we could make point counterpoint, and we could all sit in gray. Here is an issue that in the Bible, from the Jewish side to the Christian side, from the G all the way to the R, is completely unambiguous. Whether we're starting with, like, the idea of, like, For you were once a stranger and a slave in Egypt, all the way to Hebrews, where it says, like, those who have entertained strangers have entertained angels unaware. It is unambiguous in terms of how the Jewish Christian person is oriented toward the resident alien. If you want to be on the grounded, practical side of this reality, then I am inviting you to actively embrace those who are different than you are so that you, lucky you, blessed you, will encounter more of God, who we know to be love. Now, let me say something clearly before you push send on the email, because I've upset you. There are issues that we encounter as preachers that to you, because of the culture, and sometimes to me, feel political. It seems as though I, standing in the middle of this aisle today, am giving you a Democratic talking point, anti the Republican talking point on immigration. What I would tell you is, if that is what you observe, you are observing my position incorrectly. What you're observing is a person who is immersed in the sacred story, the Jewish Christian story, who has gone so far to immerse himself in that tradition to become a professional. And the profession that I embody, and by the way, the one that the institution itself, including this institution, expects, is for me to be a moral leader. If I don't make commentary on these moral issues, then I'm not doing my job. I don't care who you vote for. I don't care who you vote for. What I care about is how to get you from one stuck place into a place that is so much bigger and so much more glorious and so much more loving, that at this point in your life, no matter how old or how young you are, you don't have a vision for it yet. And I want to get you there because I've been there. And it's beautiful. And it's more. And it's loving. And it's that which helps us make the change that we need to make in our own lives and in our own culture. I quit. I'm in.